Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon. And Ron, I don't think we should be doing the podcast today. Could we do it tomorrow?
No,
I had plans for today.
My feeling is that we should have done this podcast yesterday.
You may think so, but I had plans today and you didn't let me
know.
If
you will look at the calendar, I think you will see quickly that this is the day.
I think
we made our point here.
No, but here's the thing. I think I disagree with you on what this all was, because I kind of think, just as I've expressed in the past, that I think the Republicans acted badly in the debt ceiling stuff, I think the Obama administration, the White House, is wrong on this.
The president is very poorly served whoever told him
I think this was a smart thing to do.
And whoever told him that they had gotten John Boehner to sign off on this should be fired.
And
because two things. Number one, we don't know if the speaker can say something is okay.
Right.
The speaker does not run the House majority.
We've learned that.
The House majority runs the Speaker of the House. And so he could go back to his people and say, oh, by the way, the president's coming Wednesday night. And they could say to him, no, that insults our Republican presidential candidates who are about to have a debate at that exact time. And he's just sticking it in our ear.
You know what it really was?
At which point, Boehner would have said, oh, gosh. He's just sticking it in our ear.
Well, I think you're dissing John Boehner more than you need to. There's some truth in that. I think the real issue is that, will Thad McCotta be heard? No, but here's the thing. I think the president, for Jay Carney, the press secretary, to say that,
it's
a complete coincidence.
Yeah.
Does anybody believe that?
Absolutely no one does. And that is a silly, disingenuous thing.
And now the Democrats are saying, oh, the president caved. Once again, he compromised. That's not the issue. I think he made the mistake to begin with by insisting on the 7th, and Boehner and the Republicans said, wait a second.
This is a deeply disturbing incident only in this one sense. I mean, it's a time completely minor little drop in the bucket in any historical sense, except for this one thing. This is symbolic of how the White House fails to understand how you negotiate with a hostile Congress. It's as though they forget every week what they learned the week before, that there are a group of people running the House of Representatives who are not their friends, who do not play by whatever rules the White House expects them to play by, who may negotiate something with the White House and then decide, no, we can't sell that to most of our members,
and most of
their members will just say no.
Yeah.
So whatever it is they think that Congress up there on the Hill is, or whatever it is they think they can do with it or about it, they're wrong. They need to go back to square one and figure this out. They need another form of intelligence coming from the Hill. They need another conduit of information, or they need some other means of negotiation.
I read somewhere today that it said that all those who hope for a good working relationship between the White House and the Republican Congress, who thought that would happen?
Maybe some of us did at least hope for it, because there have been hostile houses of representatives that worked with White Houses. There have been in the Reagan era,
in the
George H.W. Bush era, even in the Clinton era, when the House was literally impeaching him and the Senate was trying him on those impeachment charges. Even then, there was probably a better degree of savvy within the White House about how they would deal with these folks that they were dealing with. It's astonishing.
I'm hearing absolutism from both sides on this, and there's no chance for any kind of accommodation in the next... Look, I mean, once again, we're approaching an election year. It seems like we're always approaching an election year, but especially the Republicans want to finish what they began in 2010, and that's what 2012 will be all about.
Well, we're in an election year for all intents and purposes.
Exactly, always.
And the disappointing thing about all this, for those who had, as you said, hope for a little better performance from Washington this fall, possibly including the S&P rating service, those folks are going to be disappointed to see that the message that both the White House and the Congress got from August is the exact opposite of the message that people thought they were sending. People thought all this disapproval was going to make the White House and Congress maybe a little bit repentant, maybe a little bit shamed. They were going to sit down and try to behave with each other a little better. But instead, the message they seemed to have gotten was the message from their hardcore base, which was, don't give up a thing. Don't even negotiate. You should not even be talking to those people. Let's just go to war. And that appears to be what they came back to Washington intending to do.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I still think, again, if there's a good guy and a bad guy, I still think the White House handled this wrong. But your basic pronouncement of the philosophy of the two parties is exactly right. So we do have a debate coming next Wednesday. We're going to have that either way. The Republicans in Simi Valley, NBC and Politico are going to have this debate.
At the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library.
And speaking of the next Ronald Reagan, Rick Perry will make his debate debut.
Yes, Rick Perry would very much like this to be seen in exactly those terms. The transferring of the mantle from Ronald Reagan at the Presidential Library with the old Air Force One in the background, and his emergence as the new uniter of all Republicans, the fiscal conservatives, social conservatives, religious conservatives, secular conservatives. This is his dream come true, really, to emerge at this debate. But in a sense, he's really already gotten the pop, hasn't he? I mean, he's leading in three major national polls by multiple.
This is why I yell at you all the time by saying we do not need to anoint a front runner or describe a front runner, because that could change on a dime.
Well, and
it is changing even before the voters have had a say in this.
Yes, and I wonder, even actually looking at these polls, because Perry leaped out to 29, I believe, in the Rasmussen, and 29 in the Gallup. 29%, of course, is not an overwhelming figure. Hillary Clinton 4 years ago was well over 40, I believe, in terms of the Democratic primary voting populace. That did not get her nominated. So it's not over or anything. And I do believe that Rick Perry is going to come to earth in the weeks and months ahead, possibly for a visit. But they haven't been able to quite bring him in on a rope yet the way, you know, obviously these other candidates are hoping to do. And that begins on Wednesday night.
Yes, and everybody's trying, though. I've never, in all my years of following this, I don't remember ever a candidate coming into the race with such coverage, with such unbelievable coverage. And I would say, I dare say that, like, 85% of it is completely negative about his bad relationship with the Bushes, about his taking credit
for... Wait a minute,
is
that entirely bad publicity, to have a bad relationship with the Bushes?
No, that's a good point. That's a good point, because being close with George W. Bush and the Bush family in 2011, 2012, in this era of Tea Party anger at the past, may not be the worst thing in the world. That's fair.
I would actually go so far as to say the worst story a lot of people heard about Rick Perry in recent days was one about him calling up, or his staff calling up, Donald Rumsfeld to ask for advice about foreign policy. And then Donald Rumsfeld says, you ought to get that guy Doug Feith. He was the guy who set up the Iraq invasion for us. Unbelievable. Can you make this kind of stuff up? Nobody is very happy, I don't think, about the Iraq invasion except Dick Cheney.
Right. And he actually wasn't in his latest book. He's talking about that we should have invaded Syria and the Bronx. Two hotbeds. But anyway, speaking of hotbeds, I mean, all we talk, everything about Rick Perry is everything he's ever done, whether he should deserve to take credit for the job situation, the economy, his statements about Social Security.
It's creationism.
And evolution and creationism. And yet he...
Global warming.
And yet it's not sinking him. You know, he's not sinking the polls. Remember, every time Sarah Palin would say something surprising or wrong, everybody would roll their eyes and say, you know, the numbers come down. But right, at least until Wednesday, so far... I mean, we're only talking about a week or two, but Rick Perry seems to be on the ascendancy.
That's right. And I wonder sometimes if when Sarah Palin rises and falls, when Michelle Bachmann rises and falls, when other sort of supernova candidates appear and then they fade away, we have a tendency to associate the fading with news stories. We like to think that our profession, that journalists are really having some sort of an impact, and that if we catch somebody in the Katie Couric interviews with Sarah Palin, for example, you know, showing their gaps of knowledge, that that's really going to make a big difference and that that's what really moves the polls. I'm not absolutely convinced of that. You've got a good example here with Rick Perry. Maybe down the road we'll see people get a little bit fuller picture of Rick Perry, and maybe that'll bring him back down to earth. But right now, right this minute, the Mitt Romney people are changing their strategy. They're suddenly going to events they weren't going to go to. They're going to try to contest, for example, a Tea Party event in South Carolina this coming week on Labor Day.
And before that, he's now going to a Tea Party event in New Hampshire that he wasn't going to go to. Not only is he going to the one on Sunday, he canceled the Monday event so he can do the Sunday event so he can go to South Carolina and the Jim DeMint event on Monday. So clearly Mitt Romney must feel something. I mean, he spent all this time as not so much as a presumptive front runner, but at least somebody who just focuses on Barack Obama and not the rest of the Republican field. I think he's realizing that there are other candidates out there.
You know, and I want to drop in a parenthesis here that, not to get too far ahead of this process, but I still am not convinced that Mitt Romney is going to fade away.
Oh, I agree.
I think he's going to be, if not the nominee, I think he's at least going to be a formidable player in the process, and that at some juncture or another, he and Rick Perry will really pair off, and that they're going to be the Obama and Clinton of 2012. We'll see. There could be a third name in there. Maybe we're still underestimating the upward mobility, if you will, of the Ron Paul candidacy. Maybe Michelle Bachmann's going to make a comeback. And we still have to deal with the prospect, the possibility of Sarah Palin. Here's another scheduling story. Sarah Palin was going to be headlining this event, and now she apparently is headlining this weekend, Labor Day weekend event in Indianola, Iowa. Big Tea Party thing. She was the star. Then she was off the program because she was objecting to something possibly having to do with Christine O'Donnell coming from Delaware, the failed Senate candidate.
Which person?
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you.
We do know this. She cost the Republicans a seat in Delaware that they would have otherwise won if she hadn't beaten Mike Castle in the primary.
She cost Rhino Republicans.
All right. She cost the Republicans one more seat
the
Senate.
That's right.
And she is a problematic character, really serious. I mean, she has a book out about her campaign and so forth. But clearly Sarah Palin does not want that controversy attaching to her event.
Who knows what she wants?
And, well, I'll tell you, she wants everybody to be paying attention
to
her.
Here we are. That's for sure.
She wants to be in the podcast again. That's what Sarah Palin wants.
Actually, I've been listening to the last several podcasts. I'd like to be in the podcast again. Okay, so we have that. You're missing the most important thing of the week, though.
Working at it, yeah.
George Pataki. I know.
I am going to miss him.
What was he thinking?
I'm going to miss him. I really am. Now, here's the real question. We should start a pool right now. Now that George Pataki is out, how much longer will it be before it's okay for Rudy Giuliani to say he's not running either?
Well, I think he accomplished what he needed to do. I think the presence of Rudy Giuliani really scared George Pataki out of the race.
Or did Pataki accomplish what he wanted to do, which was pushing the Giuliani announcement back so far that it was just too late?
You know who this benefits? Tim Pawlenty.
No question.
Yes.
I think the Pawlenty candidacy is going to come roaring back.
We made the case. Okay, so we know we have the Republican debate on Wednesday, but we still don't know the date of Iowa and New Hampshire because it seems like, a lot of the other states are talking about moving up their primaries and caucuses, and the latest to do this apparently may be decided on Saturday because Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, is talking about having her primary moved up from March to January 31st.
And it would be decided on Saturday because?
Because in the state law, you have to give notice 150 days in advance, and 150 days from Saturday is January 31st.
Now, I know the listener already knew that.
So we're going to have some kind of indication from Jan Brewer. And, of course, if Jan Brewer moves up to January 31st, you know that Florida and Michigan will also move up. And, therefore, Iowa is now going to be September 4th, 2011. I think it would be a really great idea.
Actually, this is not entirely a joke. Iowa could be as early as this fall.
Well, it won't be, but remember last year,
It could be as early as December, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
December 5th. And that is still in the fall because December 22nd is the day that winter begins.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah.
Remember, four years ago,
yes,
January 3rd was the Iowa caucus, and then that was unbelievably early. But everybody's not convinced, because first of all, if these states move up, if the non-Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada states move up into January or before March 6th, they are threatened with loss of half their delegation.
Okay, but what does that really mean?
Well, I'll tell you what it means, because remember what happened in 2008 with Michigan and Florida. They moved up, and because they were threatened with loss of delegates, Obama wouldn't campaign. And now Hillary Clinton said, I don't care, I'm still going to campaign there. But I think had Michigan and Florida stayed where they were, and as it turned out, it was a very long, prolonged Obama versus Clinton battle for the nomination, that could have been significant.
They probably would have still gone for Clinton.
Yeah.
Certainly Michigan.
Yeah.
And that,
Florida,
and probably
too,
Florida, too. Hillary Clinton might have had a lot more delegates, and that fight might have gone all the way to the convention. She might even have been the nominee. So these kinds of scheduling changes can have an enormous impact. But as a practical matter, what really does a state give up if the party enforces its rules? It may be giving up its better chance to really have an impact, but it's hard to convince them of that when they see Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina getting all this attention. Arizona gets jealous of Nevada because Nevada gets to go earlier than Arizona. So they jump. Michigan follows. Florida follows. And I believe if Arizona does, those other two states will.
Absolutely. But we saw in Florida and Michigan in 2008 that the media didn't come into those states. Most of the candidates didn't come into those states. So they lost first of all, the revenue they were hoping to get from the attention, and they actually lost the attention because they were threatened with sanctions.
All right, but would that be the case again this time in 2012? In other words, if Arizona is in the mix, does Mitt Romney go into Arizona and really contest that? Or do the other candidates join him there? Does he pull a Hillary Clinton, in other words, repeating her strategy from 2008 with regard to the early jumping states?
See, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that by moving up really, really early these back-of-the-pack candidates who are hoping for a prolonged calendar, elongated calendar, if it's going to be late December, mid-December, the not that the Gingriches and the Santorums and the Herman Cains of the world and perhaps John Huntsman of the world were ever going to make a difference, but I think their chances get completely wiped out if it just moved up until a couple of months from now.
So is there a candidate among the Republicans who in some sense actually benefits from the blowing up of their regular calendar?
Well, I would think from the beginning it's always either the people with the most attention, like a Rick Perry, the people with the best organization and the most money, which is Mitt Romney, and ultimately that may be an Eisenhower versus Taft, Reagan versus Ford, Rockefeller versus Goldwater challenge. Less ideological, but again, one of those big dramatic battles in Republican Party history that could be between those two.
So while it doesn't necessarily give us the name of the nominee, it might accelerate the process by which this comes down to just two guys.
And what's sad about that is that this is the first time in history, or at least in memory, that the Republican Party, for most of the early primaries and caucuses, they will be proportional. They won't be winner-take-all. So if they were a multi-candidate field, it would have the opportunity, at least, to extend several months. But by moving up the calendar so early and knocking out half the field, that prospect could be eliminated.
It's also possible that by concentrating all of the vote to Mitt Romney's right in one candidate, that gives that one candidate more of a chance to knock him out than he'd have if he were splitting it all with Ron Paul and Michelle Bachmann and who knows who else might still get into this race.
And that means no brokered convention.
But there's still hope. There's still hope. We'll still see it in our lifetimes. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week.
No, not next week. We don't have to. Maybe
yeah,
next
no,
week.
It's going to be
what
next
day?
Week.
What
we're
day?
Gonna, all right, we're going to do it on the normal day, the right day, the day that people.
That
no,
may not be
the
good.
The day that people say we should do it is the day we should do it.
We used to meet every Thursday in the afternoon for a couple of beers. Then a game of pool. We used to go to a motel across the street. Then the name of the motel was the Wagon Wheel.